Thank you for being here this morning. To those of you who are visiting, I'm not the guy who normally stands up here on Sunday morning, and I'm sure that that will be painfully evident in fairly short order, but we're going to look at a topic that I've been chewing on for some time, and let me tell you how the story came to pass, or how this lesson came to pass. Elijah makes fun of me for remembering dates and times and years and when things happened. But on Wednesday evening, January 28th of this year, and I'll tell you why I remember that. It was either Jay or Elijah attributed the statement, "There are some things I've got to set on fire," to a man who had decided to make some changes in his life. He was going to separate himself from some influences that were causing him to stumble and fall. It was reported that this is what the man said about some things that he owned. "There are some things I've got to set on fire." He indicated by this that those things needed to be destroyed to terminate their influence in his life. He saw the problem. He recognized the fact that the problem was a problem, and he decided to do the very thing that he needed to do to get the problem out of his life. Now, that line I quoted jumped on me and has stayed with me for months now. I wrote it down right then on my notes app on my iPhone, and when you do that, it puts a date on there when you prepare that file and put it on your iPhone. So that's the reason I remember when it was. It was Wednesday night, January 28th. I told Jay that evening it really ought to be the title for his next lesson. And I think I also told Elijah that same thing. Well, I couldn't get either one of those two characters to do anything about it, so I decided I'd do it myself. Why set anything on fire? What good is that going to bring? What purpose is that going to serve? Scripture provides us a lot of purposes of fire, and we're going to look at three of them this morning. But first, we've got to set some ground rules. We've got to know what fire is. And I dug around and I found a pretty good definition of fire. I never had thought of it in these terms, but when you think about it, it makes sense. Fire is defined as a phenomenon consisting of the sudden and abundant evolution of heat and light produced when bodies known as combustibles enter into chemical combination with the gas named oxygen. The term combustion in the modern language of physics has been adopted to express this phenomenon. Long story short, you get something hot enough, it's going to burn. Around oxygen, anyway. It does a lot of things. It destroys. It purifies. It motivates, and those are the three things that we're going to talk about this morning. I'm certain there are other things that it will do, but that's not part of the lesson that we put together. But let's start with the first one. Let's talk about destruction. If you get anything hot enough, it's going to burn, and it will burn to the point of destruction. But you've got to set it on fire. God made this point in reverse with Moses in Exodus 3. We read there, "Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. The angel of God appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed." How many of you ever burned a brush pile? Bunch of us. Have you ever set a fire to a brush fire and it not be consumed? That would strike your attention, would it not? Well, that's what happened to Moses. Moses This had an impact on him, and he turns around and he says, I will now turn aside in verse 3 and see this great sight, why this bush is not burnt. Moses was in awe. He had never seen such a thing. When a bush burns, it's consumed. It burned up. It's ashes. Or at least that had been Moses' experience up until that time. Now, in reverse, the Lord is teaching Moses a lesson there and getting his attention in the process. David says in Psalms 97 and verse 3, a verse that we're going to look at a little bit later on too, a fire goeth before him and burneth up his enemies round about. David says that God's enemies are destroyed by burning. In Isaiah 43 and verse 2, the prophet says that God says this, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. Through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. Much like Moses watching that non-burning, burning bush, God promised his people that the fire would do them no harm. It is a promise of a miracle. A promise that natural law would be set aside. And in Exodus 3, natural law was set aside in the presence of Moses. Well, we turn back to Daniel 3, and I'm going to read a paraphrase, if you will, of the story there of three fellows that you'll remember. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, set up a great golden idol in the plain of Dura and called together his nobles and officers from all parts of his realm to attend its dedication. They were gathered before the massive image when a herald announced that all men were required to fall down and worship at the sound of the instruments, and whosoever refused or failed to do this was to be cast into a burning furnace. Well, after the act of adoration, certain persons approached the king and accused three high officials, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, of defying his authority. Well, the enraged king ordered the offenders before him and recited his unalterable mandate to them. They replied, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, the God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Now this great king, so heroically defied, waxed furious, and ordered the furnace heated seven times hotter than normal. The rebels were tightly bound and cast into the raging fire, whose flames actually slew the executioners. The king looked into the furnace and saw the three worthies walking unbound and unharmed, and with them a fourth person like the Son of God. The astonished king, calling the Hebrews by name, confessed that they were servants of the Most High God. At his command they came forth with no mark of fire upon them or even a singed hair. Then Nebuchadnezzar issued a decree to all people prohibiting any utterance against the God of these worthies, because there is no other God who can deliver after this sort. Natural law was set aside, and it was set aside to make a point. There was no destruction there when destruction should have taken place. Well, fire purifies. If you get anything hot enough, it will be sterile. No question about it. You get it hot enough, it'll be sterile. But you got to set it on fire. That's a continuing thought throughout this lesson. You got to set it on fire. Turn back again to Psalms 97:3. Fire goeth before him and burneth up his enemies round about. We talked about that just a moment ago. When you read that verse, it does absolutely no violence at all to this verse to consider the fire and the destruction that it causes to be a fire of purification. Prior to the fire's use here, The author presumes that the reader will understand the pestilence existed, and that pestilence is God's enemies. Now, afterward, the pestilence was gone. Here you have a purification, a destruction of, and a resulting sterility from pestilence. Another example in that regard, let's read some about Nadab and Abihu, characters that we know from the Old Testament for one thing, and one thing only. But there's some other things about Nadab and Abihu that along the way kind of get shuffled over to the side, and we don't consider who they were. Exodus 6 and 23 tells us Aaron took him Elisheba, the daughter of Amminadab, sister to Nahashon, to wife. And she bare him Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. Now they were two of the sons of Aaron, the older brother of Moses. They were in the line of the people who would be the priests. They were the sons of the first priest. Now in Exodus 24, we read in verses 9 and 10, "Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were the body of heaven in his clearness." Now apparently Nadab and Abihu were a part of the work and accepted as part of the work that Moses and Aaron did in God's service. In Exodus 28:1, Moses ordered, "Take thou unto thee Aaron thy brother and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office, even Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's son." They were separated out by name to serve in the priesthood. Okay. They were at one time held in high regard by God. He called them out by name to serve in the priesthood. But in Leviticus 10, verse 1, we read, "Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer and put fire therein and put incense thereon and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he commanded them not. And there went out fire from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord." This is why we remember them. They are of note for no other real reason in the Old Testament other than what they did and what resulted in what they did. They're not remembered for their bloodline. They're not remembered for their previous service. Nothing about their lives up until this time causes us to remember anything about Nadab and Abihu. They were destroyed because they disobeyed God, and that's why we remember them. These men were not novices. They were not destroyed because of an act of ignorance that might have been committed by a novice. They were destroyed because of their rebellious attitude and their heart of disobedience. Numbers 26 and verse 60 tells us, "Unto Aaron was born Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, and Nadab and Abihu died when they offered strange fire before the Lord." This is a very, very pared down, very truncated retelling of the story with virtually no details involved whatsoever. But bear this in mind. In this verse, in Numbers 26, 60, and 61, we are provided the effect, which was the death, and are then provided the cause of the death, because they offered strange fire before the Lord. It's always been very interesting to me that the very thing that they offered in sin, that was the strange fire, was very much the instrument of their destruction, the fire that went out before the Lord. Nadab and Abihu became disobedient, and God considered their disobedience worthy of the destruction that is reserved for pestilence. Now, is there any reason, as we sit here today and we think about it, is there any reason to think or to believe or to conclude or to understand that he considers disobedience differently in 2015 than he did when Aaron was the high priest and his four sons were helping him in the priesthood? Let me answer that question for you out of Malachi 3:6. Malachi 3:6 says, I am the Lord, I change not. That's an important, important, important verse. Because as you listen to some preachers and teachers who preach and teach these days, the God of the New Testament is not a 30-second cousin three times removed from the God of the Old Testament. But the God says of himself in Malachi 3:6, I am the Lord, I change not. His attitude towards sin, disobedience, rebellion, pestilence, nothing has changed. Well, fire is also a great motivator. If you get a man or a woman to understand their soul's lost condition, they'll change their condition, but they've got to be set on fire. They've got to be set on fire. We're going to talk about this in a little bit at the end of the lesson. We're going to talk about change, and we're going to talk about motivation and some other things. But for the time being, think about what causes you to change anything in your life that you're not comfortable with. Change is hard. Change is difficult. Change is uncomfortable. Comfort zones are exactly that. They are comfortable. And people don't want to get out of their comfort zones. Well, let's go back to the title of the lesson. There are some things I've got to set on fire. Let's rephrase that a little bit. Let's pose it in the term of a question. Are there some things you've got to set on fire? And any time I point a finger, there's always three fingers pointing back at me. Are there some things I've got to set on fire? Well, set on fire for what? Set on fire for destruction. Are there some things in the way that you have to destroy to clear a path to God? What are those things? You've got to identify them so you can see them clearly. If they are your soul's enemy, they can cost you your soul. They have to be identified in order to be destroyed. The great Chinese general, strategist, and philosopher Sun Tzu, who lived some 500 years before Jesus, articulated this point and addressed it in a document that he wrote, and which is still studied now in the military universities throughout the land, called The Art of War. It is still accepted in the United States, in the military arm of the United States, as doctrine. You've got to identify the enemy to know who he is. That's not hard to understand. You've got to know who the enemy is. Well, what are some of these enemies? Possessions? Do you possess them or do they possess you? Is the demon of acquisition sitting on your shoulder, gnawing on your ear all the time? About things you want and about things that will get in the way between you and God? What about position? Is your job title more important to you than that name that was first used at Antioch? Christian. Is the title that you bear at work more important to you than that name that was given by God? Is that extra money you're going to get with a raise that you're going to get sometime in the future that's going to cause you to have extra duties, that are going to start causing you to miss services? Is that going to be worth it to your soul in the long run? And how about the influence that you're going to have over your family members by intentionally missing services? Now, I understand, I know, I realize, I've been in that position myself. Sometimes people have to work and you have to deal with it. But I'm talking about a voluntary, intentional move for an almighty dollar to keep you from coming through the door or keep you from doing some other things that Christians ought to be doing. What about the influence that you'll have on people around you? Assume that you have a good influence with people you work with. They know that you're a member of the church. They know you're going to assemble when the church assembles. They know where you are right now. They know where you're going to be this afternoon. They know where you're going to be Wednesday evening. And all of a sudden that stops because you got promoted and you're making $500 more a month or $1,000 more a month or $5,000 and you're not going to services anymore. Where is your influence at that point? What's happened to it? And let me tell you, people have a nasty habit of saying, I don't care what other people think. Let me inform you something about that this morning, my friends. What people think about you is the influence that you have over them. You can't get around it. You cannot get around that. What people think about you is the influence that you have over them. What about relationships? Got to set fire to a relationship? One of the most difficult, heart-rending issues that elders have to face ever are matters of the heart between men and women who truly love each other, but because of the condition of their marital history, they are not entitled to have each other in marriage. That marital relationship may well have to be sacrificed to clear a path to God for the people involved. And that's one of those hard, hard, heartbreaking, heart-wrenching things that elders have to deal with. Set on fire for purification. If there is a fire that has to be set in your life for purification, for the elimination of evil, whatever it may be, rest assured on this one fact. There will be pain and trouble involved in it. We just got through talking about matters of the heart a minute ago that may have to be severed so that heaven and all that it holds may be attained. There's nothing easy about this. Rhonda and I have both lost spouses through death. Indeed, she and I can truthfully assert that the agony is overwhelming. I cannot begin to imagine the pain it has to be endured to know that the one that you love still lives and that your relationship must end to obey God. But the question becomes this: will you allow that relationship, it's only going to last for a little while, to stand between you and God? There are other things that we've got to set on fire for the sake of purification. Do you struggle with substance abuse? Do you struggle with temptations that are floating around out there on the internet? Do you struggle with illicit and, you may well think, hidden relationships? And the list goes on and on and on. Fill in the blank for whatever thing in your life that you understand and realize and know that needs to be burned for the sake of purification. Romans 12 and 1 says this about this purification. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable or spiritual service. How can you do this? How can you obey Romans 12 and 1 with these things that need to be burned being carried around on your back as a burden? How can you present your body as a living sacrifice carrying that load? Set on fire for salvation? What motivates you? What causes you to change? What causes yourself to set yourself on a course of conduct to do things differently in the future than you've done in the past? Take a moment and look back at your life to a time when you decided to do a thing differently for whatever reason, something differently in the future than from that point forward that you've done prior to that time. You may not have recognized it at the time, and you may not recognize it even now. You may not have ever acknowledged that it existed, but there was something there that motivated you into that change. Humans don't change without motivation. They just don't. Because humans live in a comfort groove. They get in that groove and they stay there unless something causes them to get out of it. Something motivated you to change at some time or another what you were doing to doing something else. Well, let me read you some things that are pretty motivating. Turn back to Revelation 20. We'll read a few verses starting in verse 11. And I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every man according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. And you flip over to the next chapter, starting in verse 1, you get to read this. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. There was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. There shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, write, for these words are true and faithful. He said unto me, it is done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Now, if you're motivated by pleasure, by comfort, that's where you go. That is the ultimate pleasure. That is the ultimate comfort. But let me motivate you about something else in the next verse. If pleasure doesn't really sink in with you, let's look at this next verse. But the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. There's only two alternatives. They're both explained for you right there in just a matter of a few verses. Now, let me leave you with a short quote of one man's, what I consider to be very clear and scriptural understanding of God's condemnation and a few implications of that condemnation. And I took this from a very old book, and it was real faded, so I have to use a little flashlight so I can see it. Hell is the sentence of the damned, includes hellfire, a tremendous penalty which we dare not explain away, and whose literal import no man has authority to deny. But hellfire is not the sum of their penal sufferings. There's also the worm that dieth not, the self-consuming, everlasting anguish of a bad mind, the grim, comfortless, unutterable, destitute despair of a desolate and abominable spirit, tormented with unavailing yet inevitable reflection on the interminable miseries of the wrath to come. The sum of these things is the loss of his soul, that is, the loss of its eternal happiness and its condemnation to perpetual misery. I'm finished. We've talked about two different places. Which one do you want to spend eternity in? That ought to be a no-brainer. That ought to be a no-brainer. There's nobody in the sound of my voice that would stand up and say, I want to go to hell. But you know, there are some people within the sound of my voice that are doing everything in the world they can to get there as fast as they can because they've ignored what God says do. Pure and simple. If you're subject to the invitation this morning in any way, let us know as we stand and sing.